This week on Vaticano, discover how St. John Paul II, 20 years after his passing, continues to inspire the world through his deep life of prayer and love for the mountains. From private moments in chapel to treks through nature's silence, his spirituality shaped a papacy that moved hearts across the globe. Those who knew him, clergy, companions, and close collaborators, share powerful memories of a man who lived holiness with humility, courage, and joy. This is the story of a pope whose path to sainthood still lights the way for millions today. Vaticano starts now.
He passed away, but at the same time, he remains with us. You can see it in all countries, especially in the West. People are drawn to him once again, revisiting his life and teachings.
It has been 20 years since St. John Paul II returned to the House of the Father after his 27-year-long pontificate, the third longest in the history of the Church. But the indelible mark he left on the world remains profoundly tangible.
On Java.
He is still at work, and it is visible. People turn to God through him and receive various graces, many, many graces. I often guide people suffering from cancer who receive the grace of healing through the intercession of John Paul II. And these cases are so evident, so absolutely clear, that there is no doubt. People are convinced that John Paul II has acted.
His extraordinary charisma, which moved the world so powerfully, was born of a lifetime shaped by Poland's history. First war and totalitarianism, then decades of communist rule and the absence of freedom. Gianfranco Zwiderkowski, Vatican correspondent and former vice director of L'Osservatore Romano, first came to know the Pope in 1977.
Everyone forgets that this was a Pope who fled from war. The Nazis arrived. And he and his father walked 200 kilometers, only to return later as the Russians advanced from the other side. This Pope lived through the infamous Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact firsthand. Nazis on one side, Soviets on the other.
The horrors of the Second World War, the constant fear for his life and that of his family and friends, and the forced labor he endured as a young seminarian became a profound source of strength, fueling his stand against injustice, giving voice to the voiceless, and inspiring the fight against social inequality and political oppression.
John Paul II changed the world, and the world that we live in today, in the shape it's in, or at least in some aspects, because of John Paul's witness, especially when he went to Poland in 1979 and inspired the people by saying, "Be not afraid," and that asking the Holy Spirit to send and to change the face of this land, this Polish land.
Archbishop Thomas Wenski, whom EWTN Vatican correspondent Magdalena Wolinska-Riedi had the honor of interviewing at his residence in Miami, Florida, has Polish roots and was a close friend of Pope John Paul II for many years. His Excellency visited Poland just as powerful winds of change were beginning to sweep across the Pope's homeland.
My first trip to Poland was in 1980, a year after his visit, and the decorations were still out in front of the houses, you know, the flags, the pictures of the Pope, and you know, everybody knew that this was a
beginning of change,
the beginning of the end.
Poland was the spark that ignited the flame, but the Pope's influence extended far beyond his homeland, helping to topple regimes once believed to be unshakable in many nations. This made him a prime target for elimination. The risks involved in the process of changing the world proved to be extremely high, with danger always looming close by.
The Pope was standing, and I was sitting behind him. The second time we were approaching near the Bronze Gate, that's when the shots were fired. The Pope was standing. I even asked him, where? And he showed me that his abdomen had been shot through completely, and his hand was wounded. And after that, as he was losing blood, he lost a lot of blood. He grew weak, and that's when I was holding him up.
Even the most thorough investigations have never definitively uncovered who was behind the assassination attempt on Pope John Paul II in St. Peter's Square on that dramatic afternoon of May the 13th, 1981, when the world held its breath. It's widely believed that Soviet secret services, including the KGB, the Committee for State Security, may have been involved, possibly in collaboration with Bulgarian intelligence. Yet, despite numerous theories and speculations, no concrete evidence has ever been found to support these claims.
It's not that the order came from the head of the KGB, Committee for State Security, but it was like Russian nesting dolls. Everyone did something, so in the end, you don't know who gave the order anymore. Someone had planned it, and when the Pope went to see Ali Aga in prison and gave him his hand, saying, "Let's see each other as men, as brothers," the killer said to him, "Why didn't you die? I shot like I should have." What does that mean? Like I should have. It means as someone paid and ordered me to do it. It was this Pope, people could see it, who was dismantling the system without being solely responsible for it. Because, as he said in one of his books, it would be ridiculous to think that the Pope knocked down the Berlin Wall with his own hands.
He was not solely responsible for the fall of the communist regime in Eastern Europe, but there's no doubt that his powerful charisma and tireless diplomatic and political efforts played a significant role. Even the most prominent figures of the time acknowledged this after meeting with him at the Vatican.
He was truly impressed, truly impressed. Gorbachev told the Pope, "I have read your documents, your encyclicals, and I've come to the conclusion that something must change in Russia. I heard it with my own ears as he was leaving. Something must change in Russia. All under the influence of John Paul II's teaching."
Change came in the long pontificate of John Paul II, the first non-Italian pope since 1523 and the first ever from behind the Iron Curtain, was a decisive force behind it. His impact reached beyond the political realm in the shaping of the modern world. It transformed the church itself. The church has never been the same since that young, dynamic Polish pope ascended the throne of St. Peter.
I always remember a Polish youth song that he liked very much, which says, if I'm not mistaken, "If you want to follow me, take up your daily cross and come with me to save the world right now." In this, there is exactly who he is, the worshiper of God, the defender of man, of every man and every woman. There is everything, his charisma, his missionary spirit. These words truly embrace his entire life, especially his legacy, in reminding the Catholic world, and indeed the whole world, how to be Christians today. As he said in his first speech, "Do not be afraid."
In just a moment, we return to unveil a pope shaped by silence and prayer. John Paul II, a tireless pilgrim who traveled to the ends of the earth, a missionary and messenger of peace, but above all, a man of deep prayer. Prayer was the wellspring of strength behind everything he did. John Paul II prayed without ceasing, filling each day with prayer. Cardinal Stanisław Dziwisz, who served as his personal secretary for nearly 40 years, knows better than anyone how central prayer was to the life of the Polish Pope.
His holiness was most clearly revealed in prayer. He was truly a man of great prayer. He didn't show it outwardly. Of course, those who were close to him could see that John Paul II prayed for long periods. I don't know how many rosaries he prayed. He always had a rosary with him.
His prayer life was rich and varied, shaped profoundly by the liturgical seasons of the Church. This deep connection between prayer and the Church's feast days was a fruit of his upbringing in Poland, where such traditions have long been deeply rooted.
He loved praying with traditional forms that are sometimes undervalued, such as the rosary, litanies, and the way of the cross.
At the beginning of his pontificate, he asked his collaborators to install the Stations of the Cross on the roof of the Apostolic Palace, so he could pray there whenever he wished. Nothing and no one could distract him when he was in prayer, not even official delegations or the presence of vast crowds of the faithful. On May the 13th, 1982, the first anniversary of the assassination attempt in St. Peter's Square, he traveled to Fatima to thank the Virgin Mary for her protection. 1.5 million people were waiting for him in the square in front of the sanctuary.
He went to Portugal to place the bullet and the crown of the Virgin, and the statue of Our Lady was there. He knelt down to pray, and television crews from all over the world were present. This was the Pope, who had just survived an attempt on his life. It was a moment when people wanted to see him up close. And what did he do? He didn't act as part of a media figure. He simply did what popes do. He prayed for 25 minutes. Television networks around the world were left in silence, waiting for him to finish his prayer.
After losing his mother at the age of 9, the Mother of God became like a mother to him. The Virgin Mary was a source of strength and inner peace throughout his life. However, he didn't have a particular devotion to Our Lady of Fatima until after the assassination attempt on his life.
The Pope was aware of the devotion to Our Lady of Fatima, but not much beyond that. Yet while he was still in the hospital, the Fatima secret came to his mind. He asked for the texts, kept at the Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith, to be brought to him at the Gemelli Hospital.
Cardinal Stanisław Dziwisz shared his memories of the Pope's conversations with Sister Lucia of Fatima in an exclusive interview with EWTN in Krakow.
She said, "What Our Lady desired and what was written in those records has been fulfilled." And as a request, she asked that the Pope, together with the bishops, consecrate Russia to the Immaculate Heart of Mary in St. Peter's Square.
And so he did. The letter M, symbolizing the Mother of God, became a central element of his papal coat of arms, alongside the motto of his pontificate, the Latin phrase, totus tuus, all yours. He also wished to install a mosaic of Our Lady, with the inscription, totus tuus, at her feet, on the facade of the Apostolic Palace.
I believe that becoming a Marian Pope also depended on the fact that he was born in Poland, where Catholicism is Marian by nature. Moreover, he himself said that, thanks to certain readings he had done, he matured in a new, non-bigoted understanding of Mary as the mother of the Church.
To this very special mother, he entrusted the Church and her people, as well as all of humanity, committing them to a constant prayer that was the foundation of his entire life. John Paul II prayed unceasingly for specific individuals and asked his secretaries to place prayer requests, written on pieces of paper, inside the kneeler in his private chapel.
He truly prayed for those people, and sometimes messages of thanks would arrive, grateful for the graces received through his intercession.
The Polish Monsignor Paweł Ptasznik worked for Pope John Paul II for more than a decade.
When the Holy Father was preparing his text, whether it was homilies or documents, he used to simply dictate them, and then I wrote them down, sitting next to him. In fact, every moment he wasn't busy with work, he devoted to prayer. Even while dictating his text, he would sometimes pause, close his eyes, and I could tell he was praying deeply.
John Paul II prayed not only for his brothers in faith, but also for those distant from the church. He often emphasized that he followed a certain geography of prayer.
Every day, he prayed for the specific part of the church, for the particular community, while also trying to recall what that community was experiencing. Bishops who came to visit were sometimes surprised by how well the Holy Father was informed about their mission in the local church.
During his apostolic journeys, he embraced the region he was visiting with deep personal prayer.
He always ended his day with a moment of prayer. Whenever he returned to the nunciature, he would go straight to the chapel to pray, always without exception.
Umberto Civitarese, who began working in Vatican City in 1980, served at Vatican Radio for 44 years. He was responsible for managing press conferences during the dozens of trips John Paul II took around the world and witnessed firsthand the Pope's immense power of prayer.
I remember our trip to Mali when, after a day spent around the city seeing the slums and huge urban agglomerations under a suffocating heat and a very long mass in the stadium, once we got back to the nunciature, everybody was looking for some refreshment and for some rest. And the Holy Father got down on his knees to pray in the chapel, alone, and he prayed there and prayed.
Prayer was the central thread running through his entire life. Above all, he loved praying the rosary, which stayed with him until the very end, even when he was no longer able to speak. On the last day of his life, those in his apartment prayed for him, joined by crowds of young people gathered below in the heart of St. Peter's Square, all united in prayer before the image of Our Lady of Totus Tuus. Stay with us. After the break, we climb higher to discover St. John Paul II's profound bond with nature. Pontificate of Pope John Paul II, the third longest in the history of the Church, left an indelible mark in the hearts of the ordinary people and his old collaborators who accompanied the Holy Father in daily life in the Vatican.
They continue to tell me that when John Paul II was there, one felt at home here. This was a place where one would willingly go to and was warmly welcomed.
The Pope's intensive schedule, filled with countless meetings, audiences, and liturgical celebrations, engaged large groups of people every day who worked together with him in the Holy See's structures. But nobody complained about long hours at work, as they felt they were part of a big family.
By then, I was practically here more than at home. I don't even know how many mornings I arrived before 8. I'd go home by 5, but most mornings I was here, almost constantly with him. On Sundays, especially for visits and everything he did, There wasn't a single Sunday without a Polish pilgrimage coming to the palace.
Domenica non c'era una domenica che non c'era un pellegrinaggio polacco.
Luciano Firmani worked inside the Vatican for 42 years. He entered in 1977 under Pope Paul VI. His first personal meeting with John Paul II dates back to the beginning of his pontificate, or even earlier. At that time, he was a worker responsible for the logistics of closing the Apostolic Palace in preparation for the second conclave of 1978. The one that would elect the Cardinal of Krakow, Karol Wojtyła.
Lui è venuto.
The Cardinal from Krakow came late. He barely made it to enter because his car had broken down in Borgo Pio and he couldn't arrive before. Once he entered, the conclave began. I don't know if I heard the joke well. How come? You're not letting the future Pope in? And he started laughing.
Lì per lì l'abbiamo preso per lo scherzo.
We had taken it as a joke, and then, after the days of the conclave, he himself came out, and we looked at each other at the idea. The incredible happened.
Incredibile, sì, sì.
What struck me most was Gorbachev. He often came very early in the morning for Mass in the Pope's private chapel, just quietly, by himself. There was a special bond between them, and many of his visits were private and unannounced. You didn't even know he would come. Nobody knew it.
The face of the earth was changing thanks to all those small steps the Pope would take from the very beginning of his pontificate. With his words and his voice, John Paul II desired to reach the farthest corners of the globe. Engineer Paolo Sagretti, who worked for Pope John Paul II in the office inside the Apostolic Palace for more than 20 years, remembers his incredible strength of spirit very well. And now, in an exclusive conversation with the EWTN Vatican correspondent Magdalena Wolinska-Riedi, he entrusted for the first time his priceless memories of the World Youth Day 2000.
The Pope arrived and insisted on walking the whole way, even if he occasionally relied on his cane. He took on the entire backstage ramp, despite having serious difficulties. At one point, something struck me deeply. He couldn't move forward, and frustrated with himself, he slammed his cane on the ground. He was angry that his body wouldn't cooperate. I happened to be right there, and I was left stunned.
With the passage of time, the physical suffering was taking over, but John Paul II remained tenacious to the end of his days. He never gave up his mission, filled with the desire to spread the love of God all around. His strength to go on despite the advancing disease came from deep prayer, as we already mentioned, but also from his constant contact with the Lord outside the Vatican. Heart of nature, mostly in the beautiful mountains not far from Rome, where he would go very often. They frequently went to the Gran Sasso area to stay in the shadow of the highest peaks of the Apennines.
Gli è stata dedicata anche proprio una cima.
A peak was even dedicated to him, the so-called Giovanni Paolo II Peak, which is the one we can see up there.
E c'è anche un percorso.
There is also a path that is called precisely the Giovanni Paolo II Path.
In the first years of his pontificate, he would sneak out of the Vatican, hiding behind a newspaper spread out in his car, only in the company of his secretary, Don Stanislaw, and another two or three priests. In the spring or autumn season, he would go hiking in the mountains, but he didn't miss his excursions even in the winter. He was an excellent skier, and he used to take the cable car among other people, until once he was caught and recognized.
Well, sometimes there were funny incidents, like in Ovindoli. The Pope was coming down the mountain and suddenly, somewhere halfway, he stopped to pray. A little boy drove up. He was perhaps 8 or 9 years old. He looked and shouted, "Holy Father," and right after, he went down. The security said, in this case, we have to escape immediately, closing another way, because he must have told everyone down that the Pope was up there.
Na dole wszystko, że papież z górze.
The excursions out of Rome to the mountains of Abruzzo were a great opportunity to deepen relationships with those who daily shielded him in the Vatican. The locals from the Assergi area near the city of L'Aquila always waited for him as well, even though it was known just through word of mouth that he was coming.
He would come incognito most of the times. He basically arrived in a normal car. You wouldn't notice that it was a security car. He was just like anyone else. He had his lunch up in the mountains with bread and sausage prepared on fire, together with the others of his group. Around here, he could find true solitude. Now, the tiny sanctuary of San Pietro della Gianca is a place of worship, but at that time, it was practically a shepherd's village, completely abandoned and ruined. Therefore, even this little church was just a bunch of rubble, but it remained a symbol of Christianity, and for him, it was very important.
The stunning nature that surrounded him here was for him like the image of God. Here, John Paul II immersed himself in dialogue with him. Here, he found the strength for great challenges that awaited him upon his return to the Vatican. It was here that his great legacy was being generated. The legacy that, despite 20 years having gone by, still remains indelible for all generations to come.